Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. Hold on a second. Let me get my mic set. There we go. We have a great show for you tonight. I am very honored to have in studio Ira Ingber. And Ira, it's great to have you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And let me get a little more level out of you. There we go.
How are we now?
You can move that closer if you want to.
I can, good.
You can bring that mic over.
Okay.
There we
Make
go.
A mess.
While he's doing that, I want to shout out to Mike Gormley, who is the one that introduced me to Ira and was responsible for putting this together. Thank you, Mike. This is great. I'm digging this show. I love the music. Anyway, we're going to talk a little bit today about his... There's so much to do, and I don't think I'm going to cover everything today, so be prepared for another show, another two or three at least, to cover what Ira's about and what he's doing. But we're going to talk a little bit about his background, and then we're going to get into some of his albums, which I think some of the guitar playing is just outstanding. I'm going to show these real quick right now to kind of plug them. Time Sensitive and Fact Flavored Fictions, or Fiction, singular or plural. And we're going to talk a little about this in a minute. But anyway, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thank you, Jeff,
for coming down.
Thank you.
And let's talk a little bit about your background, your influences and stuff.
Well, I was a sponge. And as good sponges, you take it all in. I have an older brother. His name is Elliot Ingber. And he bought me my first guitar.
Oh, wow.
My parents, in their wisdom, thought that one guitar player, he's a guitar player himself, thought that one guitar player was enough for the household, and so they weren't interested in having two.
Mm-hmm.
So he was on tour in the early 60s and came from New Orleans, I think it was, and showed up with this little Gibson Melody Maker. I didn't know the significance of the guy who he bought it from until later. It belonged to Dale Hawkins.
Oh, wow.
The guy who wrote Susie Q. I don't know if he wrote it on that guitar, but it was entirely lost on me at I was 12 or 13. And it was really not a very good guitar, but it was a Gibson, and that really made a difference. And so I was kind of off and running, but prior to that, prior to playing, we had a very musical house, and a lot of guys would show up at the house. Friends of my brother's, they would jam, and again, before I was playing. So this guy was there a lot who was playing this thing that was kind of weird looking. It was called a Telecaster. First one I ever saw in my life, and it was played by a guy named Don Peek, who was on your show.
Yes, yes.
Don later played at my bar mitzvah, so that was a nice gig. He got out of that one. But another guy showed up playing this real rickety keyboard that looked like it was going to fall down on these little screw legs. Was a Wurlitzer played by Bruce Johnston.
Wow.
because they were all pals.
Yeah.
The first Fender bass I ever saw was, well, I didn't know what it was because my brother was playing a Stratocaster at that time, and you know the distinctive shape, and the, of course the bass looked like it, but it was too big and it only had four strings. It was played by a guy named Larry Taylor, who just recently passed on. That was the first time I ever saw a Fender bass. So all that stuff was happening to me prior to playing, and it wasn't lost on me, but it didn't get me to play as such until that little Melody Maker showed up, and suddenly the dots started getting connected. And all of these guys were around. So Don Peek would say, oh, no, this is a this chord, you play this way, and no, do hold your pick like that. And it was not formal lessons as much as it was being immersed into this world that my brother was part of, and that slowly filtered down to me. And by the time I was 16, I had my first record deal. I was in a band called The New Generation, and we ended up on Capitol. And they didn't know what to do with us. Capitol was signing a bunch of bands at the time, and they signed this band that I got into. They were already together, but they lost a guitar player, so I got in. And so Capitol signed the band. They didn't know what to do with us, so they stuck us in Studio B. That's where we rehearsed, in the tower, for months at a time. So I'm just walking through the tower. I'm 16 years old and watching these sessions happen. And what does that do? Oh, that's a compressor. And what? Oh, don't do that. And so it was, it didn't feel, I mean, it was special, but it didn't feel unusual because I was in LA, I was in Hollywood. I was right dead center of the pop explosion. And of course, if you got a record deal, you go on Capitol. That was the record company down the street. You know, you went there. It was really a symbiotic relationship of time, the early to mid '60s, the location. I went to Fairfax High School, and everything was right there. You know, the explosion of pop music was happening in my backyard. I didn't know it that way. I just felt like the whole world was probably doing it, but in fact, it was here. Mm-hmm. And then on from there, more little record deals, and then the beginning of touring and the beginning of session work. And along the way, I never learned how to read music because I picked up the guitar and I could play pretty good, you know. And I remember early on, I got a call to play on a thing called a recording session. Who knew? So right, you get it. So I get called, and I was 17 or so, 18, and guy puts a chart in front of me. What do I do with that? Turn it upside down. Doesn't look any better. And so it, big light bulb moment. Gee, if you're going to do this, you better learn how to read music. Which a lot of people at the time said, oh, I don't want to read music. It's going to ruin my creativity. Total wrong thinking. And I was very lucky to be around people who encouraged it. Found an amazing teacher, one in particular, a guy named Joseph Valenti, who was a guy I studied one-on-one with. And he just laid down the law, this is how you do it. And I studied with him. And being around other players, I was in a band with Jay Graydon for a time. And Jay was pushing that, and we kind of pushed each other. And it was a time, I think, of real exploration of the instrument, certainly of who we were as people, and being here in L.A. So the opportunities were just endless. And then from there, touring, more sessions, and, you know, watching the business change through the 70s and 80s. And I remember one major light bulb moment was I was working in a studio in Topanga called Skyline. A very dear friend of mine owned it. And a guy came in one day with this big black box. I think MIDI hadn't yet happened. It was just prior to the DX7 coming out. But this guy came in and, what is it? Plugs it into the console, pushes, and we hear drums. It was the first Linn drum machine.
The Linn drum, yeah.
And it was absolutely, just, you could not have taken more air out of me. It was, okay, that's where it's heading. So the drummers are gone. And then soon, of course, the sequencer bass stuff, he's gone. Well, the guitar was one of those instruments that didn't really get quantifiable. Tone-wise, no two guys play a C chord the same way. So we were lucky. The guitar players were lucky as the transitions were taking place from band playing two guitars, bass, drum thing to what then became the 80s techno stuff with sequencers and synths doing their stuff. The guitar somehow survived it. And watching that morph, where people tried to get guitar controllers, which I guess they sort of work now, I don't know, but...
No, they're much better now.
They're better now, but they were hideous then. And we just gave up on just playing on a keyboard and be done with it. And then I think as the technology got more affordable, more powerful, the home studio, you know, the ADATs showed up and the digital audio workstations showed up. And so to be a guitar player at that point, it was very clear to me, and I think a lot of guys, it happened to, you started to see, well, I better learn how to record this thing at home. Because the session work was starting to change already. It was already people coming to people's homes, certainly when the ADAT happened. And then I think it was Lee Sklar. I had dinner with Lee a couple of years back, and we were talking about his normal work here. Now, Lee's at the very top of the pyramid, right? The greatest bass player in the world. He's telling me, I think he said 80% of his year is in people's bedrooms.
Mm-hmm.
Playing bass, by the way.
Yeah.
With Lee, who knows? But I mean, that was a real awakening that things had so dramatically shifted from going to the facility with analog gear, obviously, to now a one-person, two-person operation. And I've watched it happen, you know, over the course of all of these years. And I think it's hard to, you know, people want to wax nostalgic about how great it was. How great analog was. Well, I don't think it really was. I think the thinking was good. The necessity to impose limitations on yourself, to think ahead, to plan ahead, to work within this very limited sandbox. That's all you had was the 24 tracks or sometimes 48 if you got lucky. But it made you think compositionally different than you do now, where just record a bunch of stuff and we'll sort it out later. And you know, deferred decision-making is often bad decision-making, I think.
Yeah.
And that's colored my album-making. Is like, I'll just commit to something. I'm going to make a part. That's it. It's done.
But you have to admit, I remember doing sessions where I would, at the beginning of the day, I would carry like 6 to 9 guitars, a couple of amps.
Right.
And I would go to these different studios. And to me, it was kind of cool because you went to these different environments.
Absolutely.
And I know, like today, like I had Tim Pierce on, and he had mentioned last year was he finally got rid of the cartridge company because he literally does everything in his studio now at home. And there's only like one or two guys that actually drive to a session. It's usually for television.
Right. It's what has happened is the record date, as it were, has largely gone the way of the dodo bird. It's record, it's film and TV that still requires certainly orchestral dates. We still need big rooms, which we still have a few of in LA. But the ensemble playing experience, I think we all suffer for having less of.
Yeah, no, that's one of the things that I was talking. I think Don had mentioned that too. Because he played in those original sessions.
Don Peake, you're saying.
Yeah, Don Peake with the Wall of Sound.
Yeah.
And they literally had 3 guitar players, 2 basses.
Yeah, and if you tear apart those records, you know, because people have been posting these isolated tracks, you know, over the years, or Jamerson's bass parts or Bonham's drums, whatever it is. I haven't listened to the Wall of Sound ones, but I suspect if people have done them and you listen to them, they're full of mistakes. They're full of out-of-tune stuff and people dropping chords. It didn't matter. What mattered was the vibe in the room was so compelling. And certainly the arrangements were amazing. But the sound, you were just caught up in. It didn't matter that, you know, this is out of tune or this is out of time. It worked.
Well, a lot of the sound, too, was the leakage.
The leakage was a big factor.
The way the room was set up and the way they positioned everybody in the room had a lot to do with the sound. And that's one thing you don't get when you record at home, unless you have a room for it.
Well, that's true. And it's funny you bring this up. I'm working on a project right now that I've inherited that Mike Gormley got me into, which is a wonderful thing. If we have time, we can talk about it. But there's a lot of voices on this thing. It's a big choral thing recorded separately. And the artist wants to record a choir that she feels is absolutely important for this thing to come off. And I said, well, unless you have a room that's going to breathe and allow, it's not leakage, but it's the interaction, you're not going to really add the thing. You're not going to get what you want because of the fact that that very thing is missing. That seems like it's, well, how important is, you can put a plug-in reverb in it? No, it doesn't work that way. You know, and Steve Bartek, who you've had on the show, and Steve and I, we play together in Jackie O, and we're very good friends. And he's always saying, it doesn't sound like they're playing in the same room together when he's complaining about something that is sonically not working. And he's right, because of the fact that the ensemble experience is what the listener hears as, I'm home. You know, this is going to draw me in. I'm going to get the emotional impact out of this thing, which is what our intention is. But if your intention is to do that and you don't have the big room, well, you're not going to get it.
And it's especially more noticeable if you get into immersive audio where you're doing surround and stuff. The room is so important.
Yeah, yeah. And you hear the great rooms in the world, you know, Sony, the scoring stage down in Culver City, you walk in there and you hear an orchestra. It's, you know, Wizard of Oz, Over the Rainbow was recorded in that room. There's a good reason why it sounds so amazing. Yeah. You know, and on, Capitol Tower, all these places, Sunset Sound, Village, all these rooms that have lasted, there's a reason for it. They sound really, really special. So, you know, we're talking about the same thing in a different way, but I think it comes back to the ensemble thing, which that is the biggest change, I think, from my years of starting out as a kid and then playing through the change from analog to digital. Then suddenly you notice, oh, we're not playing as a group. We're not.
Yeah. And then put on top of that the fact that people will, like, just insert parts. So they'll record little snippets.
Right.
As opposed to recording a performance.
Well, and that's,
and that's, course, another thing with an ensemble,
right?
You perform more, so it's a performance.
I want, you know, we just Jackie O, our band, with Steve Bartek and John Avila and David Raven, we just did some recording a couple weeks ago for a house that's gonna do some trailer music, and we played live as a band. And we did a couple of, you know, we would do some intercuts as needed if somebody, you know, did something that was not right. But the fact that we're all playing together, first of all, we wrote, recorded, and mixed two songs in one day.
Mm-hmm.
They're instrumental, but still, a lot of it got done because of that, because of that thing we're talking about.
Yeah. Now, before I'm going to go ahead and start playing some clips and talking a little bit so they can hear what you're doing. Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, is not ensemble playing.
Yeah, now this stuff, I presume you did a lot of this just overdubbing.
It's the exact opposite of what I've been preaching.
Yes, but before we do that, I have to talk about this guitar. I want you to mention, you were this Strat. What year is this?
This is 89. Mm-hmm. It's a early artist series Blackie, Eric Clapton. It was gifted to me. My dear friend Danny Jacob, I don't think Danny's been on your show, but Danny is a wonderful guitar player, composer. I was his guitar teacher way back in the day. And he gave it to me. And I just, because all my guitars are really old, I didn't feel like taking them out, and I have an old Strat, and I said, well, I'm a little more antsy about taking it out. So he gave it to me, and it was really good, surprisingly good, with 22 frets. How about that? That's a nice little change.
That's unusual.
That's a good thing. And you mentioned Tim Pierce. I saw Tim online somewhere. I forgot where it was.
Probably his YouTube channel. He's
maybe it was. I forgot where it was. And I know Tim just a little bit. He's friends with some friends of mine. Phenomenal guitar player, of course. And he was singing the praises of this thing. Can you see it from here? Is that a good shot?
Hold it up a little higher over the mic. There you go. And then okay. I'll take it.
I want to do this for my guys in Spain, Andres and Isaac. It's called Vega Trem. And I'm not making a dime on this thing in terms of, I'm not endorsing them other than I think it's great. And I've been singing its praises. It's a tailpiece, a trem tailpiece, that requires no retrofitting. It just pops right in. And it's the smoothest. I guess we have some audio here. It perfectly returns to tune. And the better part of the bonus is you can double stop it, and by holding your hand on it, it's going to stay in tune. You know, the old Strat floating bridge problem was you bend, double stop, and that top E string is going to travel downwards.
It goes flat.
It goes very flat. The bar moves down. But if you with this one here, you can put your hand on the back of the bridge. I'm still learning how to do it. It's pretty in tune. That's what sold me. I saw Tim doing it. He can just fly on it now, so I'm going to have to get as good as he is on that. It's acoustically louder to me, to my ear.
Go ahead, play it.
Yeah, but the guitar just kind of opened up. There's nothing special about the instrument other than it's well-made.
Flip it around so they can see the back.
Yeah, okay, so the back side has, we opted for three springs. Fren Askin, Askin Guitars. Hi, Fren. He's now putting them on all his guitars that he's building when he's building a trem. It came with three different spring tensions, low, medium, and high. I opted for the low one. I just kind of liked it. And we experimented with placement. We found that the three I liked a lot, three low tension. Mm-hmm. But the block is very skinny compared to the stock Fender one. And I don't know if that makes it. And I saw them at NAMM, and I finally met the guys who designed it. And I said, "So is it because it's so skinny? It sounds louder."
Hand me the guitar. I'll show it to him on camera.
But here's the guitar. Am I making a mess of things? There you go.
Okay, so you can see here. It's a very narrow. It's not as block. The block on a standard Fender Strat is pretty big, and then he has these three springs, and they're pretty. They're not too taut. You can see that the claw is down a lot, so mm-hmm. it's not really, but it's real stable, and it comes back.
It comes back amazingly back to pitch.
So you can see it has four screws that's this like set piece, and I guess the bridge floats in there.
It's covering the fulcrum part of it,
right?
And the blade goes under that little plate, and it's locked in place. So it's a very very smooth travel, way smoother than. I mean, Fren was also saying that he has not found one as smooth as this. And so we were blown away by it. The initial one came with bridge saddles that were too short. We couldn't intonate it. And so I just said, well, screw that. I'm done with this thing. Mm-hmm. And so I called or I wrote them and I said, well, I'd love to use it, but we can't get enough travel out of the saddle. So they sent me, they were very apologetic and very European polite. As we know, people can be there. And he said, oh, I'm so sorry. I'm going to send you new ones. And he did right away. And so we had the D string and the E string needed a little bit more travel. And so it's perfectly in tune now, perfectly intonated.
And it's real stable. I was playing with it before the show, and it's balanced really well. So it comes back right. Once you get the guitar set up, it...
I mean, you could dive bomb with it if you wanted to, but you know when I use this one live with the band, I think I tuned it three times for an entire show. So, Vega Trem, go.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and play a clip. We better let people hear what you sound like.
What's it going to be?
Let's go ahead and the one you had sent me. I really like this one. I want to talk about this because it kind of shows a lot of what he's doing. My feeling is, and I'm prejudicing everything by saying this, but he has a very progressive feel in terms of his rhythms and harmonically. So I'm going to show this because it really goes all over the place, and it's called When Is Somebody?
When Is Someday?
When Is Someday? Oh, God, I keep misspelling everything.
So and when you say it goes all over the place, it used to be AOR radio was called All Over the Road, right?
All Over the Road. No, it's really just I love the changes and what's going on. And in this album too, Flavored Fictions. Mm. And there's just guitars everywhere on this. So this is really cool. So let me go ahead and play this.
When is Sunday, will it come for me? You promised one day you'd be here and I would be all right. I expect to find the answer. But Sunday comes for you. Sunday comes for me. How long do I hold on to the memory of lovers who've come and have gone? I remember everything, even things that didn't happen. We can make them happen again.
Now, there's a lot of stuff going on in that song, and the tones that you're getting out of the guitar is just fantastic.
Thank you.
Are those direct or they're amped?
No, those were all amped.
Kind of just go through a little bit what you were doing there.
In reverse order, the last there's that solo was two parts, and I'm trying to remember where I was. What was I wearing that day? In my house, all done in my studio. The second solo was a 12-string Dan Electro, which I love. It's a junk guitar that's just amazingly great. But I was playing slide with the 12-string, which is sort of an out-of-control experience because typically when you play slide, you're muting the strings that are not in play so you don't get a bunch of noise. But you can't mute all the 12 strings because that second string, it'll run away from you.
Yeah.
And so sometimes you get some pleasant surprises. And I remember that solo, I had to do a lot of takes because I would get the notes I wanted, and then I got some notes I didn't want.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had to kind of figure where to mute your right hand, your left hand. So it was kind of an obstacle course, but it worked out well because it was a good contrast. The first guitar was my Yamaha, an SG model. That way back, I was part of the evaluation team.
Mm-hmm.
They gave a bunch of them out to us, and it was designed to be their Les Paul killer in the 70s. It's a beautiful guitar that weighs so much you can't play it live. It's a brick, but it records great, and that was the first of the two solos. The amp was probably, I want to say it was probably the AC-15 for that. Because I think I just got it and I was totally in love with it. And you know how you are. You get something new and you use it on everything.
Because you get that kind of it's not nasally, but kind of like a hollow.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and that's typical of what that AC-15 does with the Blue Celestion. It's a very chimey amp, of course. It's Vox. But it also has a mid-range scoop that really allows a lot of guitars to work with each other because they're not loading up. And so the EQ on that amp is, it's crude, of course, it's a Vox. I mean, it's sort of on and off. But when you get that sweet spot, you can really find how it's going to sit in the track in relation to the other pieces that are there. I want to mention that the drummer on this is a really good friend, M.B. Gordy. He was playing to a loop I made, and he said, well, your loop's better than me. I said, yeah, but you're better than the loops. I just played. And my dear friend Carl Seelove is playing bass.
Yeah, I love that. There's some great little lines that he does with you.
Carl and I go way, way, way back. Carl and MB had worked forever. And I think that's part of the thing, too. You have friends playing together. And, you know, it's not just a good time, but it's also great communication. And we know kind of what everybody's up to.
You know? Now, with Carl, did you lay a track with him so you were playing together, or you just had him come in and overdub it?
Because
it seems intuitive what he's doing.
Yeah,
against what
you know,
you're playing.
I'm pretty sure that he came separately, and it's been a while now. A lot of times with Carl's stuff, he'll play things just as, not as a doodle, but just as a riff, and I'll come back later and play along with it as if it was a composed part.
Oh, okay.
So that what he thought was a throwaway is now a line that's intended to be, you know, very strongly stated.
Oh, okay.
So we do a lot of that
stuff. Because it sounds like you're kind of playing.
There's a lot of interaction. And MB also, because he's such a great percussionist, he was playing snare with his hands, not sticks. So it had a really unusual attack. It wasn't overpowering.
All right, let me play another one. Let's see. I'm trying to think of which one is. Okay, I'm going to go over to Time Sense. I'm going to jump around a little bit. This one, to me, what's interesting about this song is the way the rhythm guitars play against each other until now. And that kind of counterpoint. Then I'm going to ask you a little bit how that was recorded. Okay. So this is from Time Sensitive. And this one is called Until Now. Take a listen.
Until Now. There is no shame and nothing to hide. There was no skin in the game until now. Each moment in time was a world set apart, each one my mountain to climb. You can know me. Saw me, really saw me. This clear light here somehow in the dark, out of touch until now.
It's almost like an art pointillism. There's like little things.
Way you edit it, though, I was having a hard time figuring where one was. I'm thinking, I should know this song, and I couldn't. I did. Where you cut it was...
The songs are... There's so much going on. I'm trying to catch a good sample of all of the changes that you're going through. So I cut it not where the normal spot to cut.
You definitely did. I never did figure where one was.
But I mean, it's just amazing all the different things that there's just so much going on in there. But I love the way the counterpoint rhythmically to the whole thing. It's just, and then some of the stabs with the guitar, like brass stabs.
Well, that's a good thing to bring up quickly. I've always been in awe of horn players, because to me, the first lead guitar player was a horn player. You know, I just, that, like Big J. McNeely and all the Maceo and all those guys who could play those long notes that, you know, we were looking for with, you know, distortion and sustain and compression. They did it naturally because the instrument just did that. And years later, playing with horn players, playing figured parts that we would both, either in harmony or unison, It was really exciting because you get the texture of the horn, but the attack and the bite of the guitar. And the sum total was more than the, you know, the sum being more than the parts. So I think that way. Horn stabs, horn parts that are not played by horns.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Vocals, thinking horn parts, guitars. I'm working on a new tune now that's a clavinet playing horn stabs. Because horn stabs by themselves are like, okay, that's been 60, 70 years of that. But I think when you use that concept and try a different instrument doing it, you're changing the context a little bit. You're changing, not the context as much, you're changing the ingredients.
Right.
And I think it makes a more compelling listen so that we're not, for me, the shape of the songs, the overall structure, the arrangement ideas, if I'm not doing something that's feeling right to me, right in terms of avoiding what's been done either by me, and mm-hmm. of course I do repeat myself, we all do, but I try not to. And operating from that, it leads you to discoveries. It leads you to, wow, let's try, you know, like you picked up on those horn parts that the guitars were playing. The slide stuff does that too, because it's got that bite to it,
mm-hmm. and
long sustain without a lot of distortion. You probably saw on some of my background, I work with Lowell George a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And Lowell was
mm-hmm.
a very big influence on me. The way he would make that very gentle, you know, he would, where's the slide down here? He would do little chromatic things, you know, like he would. Just that, all that would create this motion that your ear was drawn to. It wasn't just he didn't do that. He would. So
yeah.
when you have those little moments of percussion stab, like you said, they become events. They become what I call the connective tissue of a song that sustains multiple listenings. So there's more to discover.
Well, that's every time you listen, yeah, there's something new.
There's something that you're going to get, and hopefully it's going to make you want, oh, wow, I never thought of it that way. And even me, now, years later, I can be pretty dispassionate about this stuff. I don't even think I did it. You know, hearing it's like, well, that guy's pretty good or whatever. But it doesn't sound like me. I was trying to recreate what it was because there's still things to discover even later.
Well, let me ask you real quick how you put that together, because there's some major time signature changes in that whole thing. Did you like just sequence it in and did like a you know, drum track and then have them, program it? So you got the layout of it? Was it charted?
Yes. No. Next question. A lot of times when I'm writing, I'll start with a drum something.
Yeah.
A glorified metronome. And usually it's too slow because I'm in tempo DiLerno mode. I'm trying to figure out how this thing works. And I'm stumbling through it because I'm building the airplane and flying it at the same time. So I don't know. But once the if there's a riff, let's say, of the song, okay, that's good. That's a good A section. I'll work with it. And then when I'll start to map it out on the computer, wow, that's 6/4. Wow. Because I'm not feeling, I know something is not 4/4 about it, but I'm not I'm not analyzing it in the moment. I'm just trying to get to the next part, you know, how I can connect A to B. And then when I start mapping it out, especially if other musicians are going to come and play, then I will chart it, and sometimes it looks pretty daunting because the intention was not to make it complicated. The intention, certainly when bringing musicians in, was to make it legible, you know, and God forbid, I don't want anybody to walk in and without a chart, well, okay, let's start playing. What do I do now? You know, I've my dear friend Van Dyke Parks, if you're listening, Van Dyke, this is for you. I mean, Van Dyke is gigantic. Everybody knows him as this colossal talent.
Mm-hmm.
And his charts are impossible they're just impossible. And we make our way through it. And I've come up with things I would never have played for anybody else because it's him. He draws it out of me. By the same token, though, the charts are very tough to look at. And, you know, a great reader can just say, okay, I'll just play it. But I don't want a great reader. I want someone to bring it to life who can also make their way through it. Not a lot of people like that. Carl is one of them. MB's one of them. Bartek's one of them. Everybody who's come on board to play on my stuff is that way. Mark Mann is too. Except Mark, if you're listening, Mark wants to rewrite my lyrics. That's okay too. But and we did a thing. I don't know if we're going to play that one that Mark's singing on with me, but he was questioning. Are you sure that's the right? And I said, well, I never thought of it. And we went around in circles. Said, yeah, that was the right lyric. The one I want you to sing is the one I want to keep. So, but I think in the case of all that stuff, the time signature stuff, the what sounds like it's, you know, it's this three ring circus going on. It's just my means of trying to create a unity.
Yeah. It's just you naturally change time signatures.
Yeah, it doesn't feel unnatural to me.
No, it's great, but that's part of that prog aspect of it, because that happens a lot in progressive music. But it's cool. It's cool what you're doing, but I mean, it seems like, yeah, and you have great musicians that know you,
yes,
so they know what you're doing. But yeah. I mean, that I could see where writing that out, it would freak people out.
Well, you don't want to do that without some disclaimers. So you say, well, first of all, your part is absolutely, if it is, you can change it. Let's start with this. Let's use it as a place. I know Bear McCreary does that when we've worked on songs or some of his film and TV cues. This is a place to start. It's paper to look at. We can refer to it. But let's bring it to life. Let's animate it. And I think that there's a real trick to that I've learned. I got it down now pretty good, but it took a while to learn that in terms of not wanting to intimidate somebody. I want them to shine.
Actually, when you hear it in context, first time I heard it, I was listening to the song. Mm. I wasn't really technically breaking it down.
Right.
When I'm listening to it, it's a certain feel. The way the rhythm changes overall, that phrase or whatever, that piece, it's a certain thing. It's a certain kind of rhythmical thingy that you're doing.
If it's leading you to feel something, then I have fulfilled my stated goal. If you walk away from it saying, nothing happened, well, then I didn't do it.
Right.
You know? And you try, I think, as a creator, one tries to communicate a specific emotion in this case, or, you know, in my case, it is that. And if I get that point across, however I did it, great. Whoop. Then knock the mic down too. But you know, it's this balancing act of wanting to satisfy myself as I'm doing this, and also wanting to communicate.
Right. All right. We're almost out of time. I want to play another thing. That's a whole. It's more of like a production session. Mm-hmm. This is Scarecrow with Lacey B. Dalton.
Lacey J. Dalton.
J.
Yeah, you're getting close there. I hope we can talk a little bit about this before or after. Or...
You want to talk?
I do. I do.
And then we'll go through it.
Very quickly. So Lacey was introduced to me through a mutual friend, and she's just the dearest heart. And she's in the Country Hall of Fame. And she was considered a country singer, and which we know is that whole genre has evaporated in terms of what we thought country is. Whatever country isn't what it was. So now she's Americana, and Mike Gormley got involved. I introduced Mike to her. I think he knew her. Anyway, we did this recording with the Jackie O rhythm section, John Aviles playing bass, David Raven on drums, and we tracked it as a three-piece, myself. I think Lacey was playing acoustic too. And then I came back to my place and we, you know, did other stuff. But this was entirely a discovery recording. What to use? Had no idea. I knew it was going to be pretty acoustic heavy. But the approach to it was just, you know, keep discovering things that are going to be a little bit off the beaten track, but still keep it within whatever it was called Americana. She's one of the best singers I've ever worked with, and here's Scarecrow.
Here, take a listen.
Dark clouds racing across the moon. Freight train blowing by here soon. Listen to what the old folks say about how fast time slips away, how everything changes, nothing stays the same, everything changes. While I was playing love for keeps, you were playing games. Now everything is different without you. Everything is different without you. You were shallow, weak and cruel. I was just a crazy fool about you. About you. About you. Friends all say that there is life beyond you. Once this pain stops eating me alive, for years and years I rested my trust on you. And I just can't believe how hard this precious soul dreamed of.
The dobro, it's beautiful.
You know, and this was an example. That solo was really hard to do. It took a long time to do it, but I kept hearing her voice. That was the guiding.
Mm-hmm.
That was the guiding. What was she saying here with the dobro slide? And I didn't get there right away. That took some doing, because what am I going to do? There's a guitar solo. What do you do with a solo? And because her voice is so much emotion in it, and she's just such a grounded singer, you know, she knows exactly phrase to phrase, word to word. She knows where she's going. She knows where she wants to end up from the very first word.
Right.
She knows exactly the trajectory. And so when the solo came in, I knew it had to build. I knew it had to then taper off and let her back in. So it couldn't be flash, certainly couldn't be electric. And so you start eliminating, and okay, the dobro, that's the guy. That's where we're going to go.
Oh, it sounded great. And all those other guitars in the background, there's the little tinkles in
the
background.
Yeah, there's some of course, the requisite tremolo baritone. You got to have that. You know, that,
mm-hmm.
You can wear your cowboy hat now with that. But I think also that instrument, also when you hear it, a little bit goes a long way. You get the baritone in there, and it's speaking in an area where nobody's competing with it.
Right.
And that helps.
Mm. Now, we're out of time. I told you this would fly by. I can't believe it. And there's so much more to talk about.
Let's talk faster.
Well, what I want to do before, I'm going to play one more clip to take us out.
Okay.
And I'll ask you about that. But I want to talk about what you're doing now with Jackie O and Bearing All.
Mm-hmm.
So go ahead and give
Jackie
us
Jackie O is a band that it is four of us, two guitars, bass, and drums. The way God planned rock bands. Steve Bartek is on the guitar. He plays flute also magnificently. John Avila, bass, singing. Both he and Steve were, of course, in Oingo Boingo. Mm-hmm. David Raven is the drummer. He sings, and David's played with everybody in the universe. We say there's 2 degrees of David Raven. Everybody knows David and myself. And we're playing this coming Friday night, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
Down the street from here, Ireland's 32. So come on now. We have a wonderful time playing. And because everybody in this band is a producer. So, you mm-hmm. know, who's ever up there singing, the three guys were up there just holding everybody else. And There's ego is pretty much non-existent, which is so refreshing. We all knew each other for a while, and then we played, and it was magic. Bearing All is not a lot of people know about it, so I guess they know about it now. It's Steve and I have been doing a project for a few years, the two of us, and inviting guests, you know, handpicked guests to come in. And so we're going to be dropping some things before too long, more experimental and more definitely the road less traveled. Let's okay. let's leave it at that, and we'll tease people.
Well, I'm gonna hopefully I'll have both of you guys on when as yeah. the album gets closer to completion.
Thank you. Yeah.
www.iraingber.com. You can get the albums over there. I think you can.
It links to CD Baby. I think.
CD Baby. Yeah. yeah through CD Baby. Mm-hmm. I highly recommend these. These are really great, and it's really interesting. I mean, we just touched the surface, but there's so much going on. All these layers of guitars, and they all work. And they all fit. And if you like a lot of interesting turns and like surprises, these albums musically have that. Whether it's a rhythmical surprise or an instrumental surprise, there's a lot of ear candy, as I say. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Jeff.
I'm gonna take us out with a song called "You Weren't in Hiding."
Huh.
You want to set that up?
I do. A magnificent boy. He's really a gem. Doug Livingston is playing pedal steel, and I have just the hugest pedal steel envy. I don't want to even touch that instrument because seeing people like him playing. And so I said to him when he played, I said, don't play it like a pedal steel. Anything but.
Mm-hmm.
Atmospherics, and Doug does that beautifully. It was the beginning of, my mother had just passed, as it turned mm-hmm. out, and it was written for her. But I didn't realize how much of it was, again, a discovery thing at the time. And so it Rick Schlosser's playing drums. Rick has played with everybody, too. He played with Van Morrison. And he got it. Doug got it. I think that all the people who, like you said earlier, you mm-hmm. know, we relate to each other as humans. And the music reflects that. And so, I mean, Doug looked at the chart and, you know, he can read Bach on a pedal steel, so he doesn't have any problem. But, you know, feeling his way through it, this is what you're going to hear.
Thank you so much, and I look forward to having you back on. This is not over yet. We're not done. I warned him it goes by really fast, but as you can see, there's just so much to talk about, and there's a lot more. I mean, even in your background and stuff. So anyway, everybody, thank you again. Thank Mike Gormley. Thank you for putting us together. And everybody, have a great week. We'll see you next week. This is You Weren't in Hiding, and this one is off of...
That's Flacked. Flacked Flavored. Fact. Flacking Flickers.
I'm contagious.
Yeah. Making
up. But anyway, everybody have a great week. We will see you next week. Take care.
I know you're near. We were never good at